Too Aware. We are dedicated to communicating information that inspires your positive growth and change. Are you interested in a peaceful planet? Are you interested in optimal health? Are you living with purpose? Are you enjoying your life? We realize each person can make a difference, and our mission is to empower your awareness. The choices that you make in every moment shape your life, and we encourage you to realize that you have your own answers and to always listen to your own truth. We invite you to stay aware. Good afternoon and welcome to Aware. Hi, this is Lisa Garr. Have you seen the low-carb craze going on out there? You drive by any fast food restaurant and you see this low-carb menu on the side of a fast food restaurant. I think it's funny. It's amazing to me, the irony of that. But that's not what the show's about. This is about something totally different. When you see something reach that level of marketability, do you suspect that there is a new way of eating out there, where there's actually a whole new way that we should be eating that we've been doing wrong for 5,000 years? Or do you think that this is maybe marketing? Maybe this is hype. Maybe this is a new way of doing things. Either way, I want you guys to listen to the show today, and I'm completely encouraging you to make your own decisions. Our crack team of producers has assembled a panel to answer this question. Low-carb diets, good for you or hype? We don't know. You guys are going to find out. We have a great roundtable discussion happening here with three experts in fields of nutrition and medicine combined. Our first guest is Dr. Mary Vernon. She specializes in low-carb diets. She is a board-certified bariatric physician, a member of the clinical faculty at the University of Kansas School of Medicine, and she has participated in the University of Kansas Energy Balance Lab Weight Control Research Program. Lots of details, lots of information. She's also with the Atkins Nutritionals Incorporated, so we know Dr. Vernon's stand. We have Mark Lovendale, who's here. He's a health researcher. He's been with us before when we did the show on the milk panel and we did the panel on mad cow. He is a health researcher. He's written a book called Quality Longevity, which is about the awareness of delayed food and chemical allergies in the body. He works a lot with testing for food allergies, which is a great concept in itself. And there's also Dr. Lisa Sanders, who's joining us. She's on the faculty of the Yale School of Medicine. She specializes in the treatment of overweight and obese patients. She's the author of a meta-analysis that looked at the safety of low-carb diets, and that was published in the Journal of American Medicine last year. And she's the author of a book called The Perfect Fit Diet. There's all sorts of diets out there. There's all sorts of perspectives on this, so I want to kind of bring it together for people to listen and make their own decisions. Okay, so welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining me today. I'm going to start off with I'm going to direct my first question to Dr. Mary Vernon. What is the reason behind the effectiveness of weight loss and these diets? Why is there all of a sudden this craze around the low-carb diet? Has it been around for a long time, or is this new?
Well, it has been around for a long time. Dr. Atkins published his first book on it in 1972, and it was around for a long time before that. So, yes, it's been around. One of the benefits in terms of weight loss is that it does target your fat storage system. It targets your insulin production, and that is something that if you can keep your insulin production low, you store less fat. One of the benefits of the Atkins diet, I think, is that it's simple, so it was easy for people to learn to do, and you aren't hungry when you eat the way he recommended. Those are two benefits that make it easy for people to lose weight and stick to it.
Okay, so I want to ask Mark, so what is it over the last 20 years that you've seen with people becoming increasingly overweight, and we have now these statistics on obesity and so forth? Do you think that this is contributing to the kind of carb craze that we've been going through in the past?
Over the last 20 years, there's been a significant increase in the consumption of simple carbohydrates. Simple carbohydrates are sugar, corn fructose sweeteners, and these have gone up dramatically over the last 20 years, which have contributed to the increase in the number of people who are overweight and obese. At the same time, there's been an increase in the consumption of refined carbohydrates. These are white flour, cornstarch, and refined cereal grains, which have gone up significantly over the last 20 years. The actual amount of fat in the diet over the last 20 years has actually stayed about the same as far as percentage of calories. It's gone from 38% to 33% over that period of time. However, because the total calories have increased over the last 20 years, the actual amount of fat consumed has actually increased over the last 20 years. The amount of protein in the diet, around 15% of total calories, has stayed the same. So the epidemic of obesity is largely brought about by an increase in calories, and those calories have come from simple carbohydrates and also refined carbohydrates.
Now, Dr. Sanders, you work at Yale with primarily working with obese patients. What do you feel is contributing to this these statistics that have been recently, advertised in the news? Is this something that's coming up as a marketing ploy? What do you think this is all about? On obesity, I should ask you.
Yes. I mean, I think over the last, I would date it back further than that, over the last half a century, how much we eat has increased dramatically. As Mark was pointing out, and how many calories we expend has dropped dramatically. At the turn of the last century, a woman in an average day burned off, it's thought, 600 calories a day more than we do. So, and we eat about 400 calories a day, 400 to 600 calories a day more now than we did even 30 years ago in the 70s. So if you add those things together, that's a lot of extra calories. You know, it's almost, it's 700 calories a day that is different. 600 or 700 calories a day extra is going to make you gain weight. And so I think that what's happened is we have gotten our eyes off the fundamental equation here, which is calories in and calories out. I'm not saying that that's the only thing that counts, but it's a very important aspect of anything that's going to either make you gain weight or lose weight. We live in a world that wants us to eat a lot and not exercise, and when you eat a lot and you don't exercise, you end up putting on weight, and I think that accounts for the great increase in obesity in our time.
What we're looking at here in terms of this perspective on the low-carb diets, the high-protein diets, et cetera, it depends on what the person's priority is. Is it weight loss or is it health? And I don't know if the diets actually do the same thing. Now, Dr. Vernon, you're on the board of Atkins Nutritionals, and you've heard, of course, the controversy about the high fat in the Atkins diet being an increase in heart disease and so forth. What is the perspective that you guys have about that?
Well, I need to remind you that I'm a consultant to Atkins. I'm actually in private practice all by myself.
But, okay.
My perspective is that what I see over and over, and what's actually been shown in the randomized controlled trials that have been done using this dietary approach, are that the cardiovascular risk factors improve tremendously. Triglycerides drop in most studies by 50%. HDL comes up in most studies by 10 or 11%, and those are huge changes. So that you really improve your triglyceride to HDL ratio. I just published a paper on management of diabetes using the Atkins approach, and we were able to normalize glucose control without people on medications for patients that came in on 2, 3, and 4 medications. So for me, it's an extremely potent tool that helps people to regain their health and regain their body's balance. So I'm very excited to be able to use it.
Now, the concept, as I understand it, behind the Atkins diet is the increase of the protein consumption requires more energy to metabolize into the body, yet burning more fat, and that is how, and then, of course, with the reduced amount of intake of carbs, and then if you add the essential fatty acids, then all of that will start to melt away the weight in some form or another. But what I'd like to find out is if you can do that, without the increase in the proteins? Is it is that an essential part of the diet?
Well, I think you have to remember that when you're talking about the increase, really you're talking about the percentages of calories. So that most people who have studied this say that if you count up what people actually eat when they eat as Dr. Atkins instructed, which is to eat until you're full, not stuffed, then they actually eat fewer calories than they were when they were eating a diet that contained carbohydrates or large quantities of carbohydrates. Because even in the most restrictive phase, Atkins' diet does contain carbohydrates. They just happen to be carbohydrates from those low glycemic sources of natural foods that I'm hoping Mark will talk about. At any rate, we aren't really certain of the mechanism, and there's a lot of ongoing research in that area in terms of is it the relative percentage increase in the protein without the carbohydrate signal to store fat? Is it the presence of the fat that helps you to feel full? That really hasn't been worked out clearly.
I think one thing that is important to take a look at are some of the recent studies that Atkins Nutritionals have been promoting as an indication that their diet is safe for people concerned about cardiovascular disease. One of those studies that they have on their website is and was published in the New England Journal of Medicine is titled A Randomized Trial of Low-Carbohydrate Diet for Obesity. In this diet study, they compared the Atkins diet to the American Heart Association diet, which was erroneously called a low-fat diet because it actually had around 25% total calories and fat. And in this study, of one of the important markers as far as cardiovascular disease is total blood cholesterol. And when studies have been done on true low-fat diets, such as the ones recommended by Dr. Dean Ornish and previously to that by Nathan Pritikin and John McDougall, diets around 10% total calories and fat accomplished a drop in total cholesterol of 26% after 1 month. Yet in this Atkins diet study in the New England Journal of Medicine, at the end of 1 year, there was no change in total blood cholesterol. Now, it is true that the triglycerides came down significantly, and that is desirable. However, in time, the triglycerides move back up, and triglycerides also come down over time in diets that have 10% total calories and fat. But the really important factor here on reversing heart disease is to have the total blood cholesterol under 150. It was shown in the Framingham study over a 50-year period, those people who had total blood cholesterol levels under 150 were free of heart disease. And more recent research has shown that when the LDL factor in the cholesterol is under 80, that heart disease is not only not a problem, but plaques are actually reversed from the arteries. What should be the goal of any diet that helps people lose weight is to also get their blood cholesterol levels under 150 and their LDL under 80 so that they can remove plaques from their arteries so they get the fat not only out of their arteries and throughout the body, but it also enables them to get the fat deposits off of their hips and anywhere else where they have additional body fat they don't want.
I would like to talk about that because, of course...
Dr. Sanders, is that you?
No, it's Dr. Vernon, actually.
Dr. Vernon. Whoops. Okay, we'll go to Dr. Sanders after Dr. Vernon. Go ahead.
Those studies were performed, the studies that you're talking about dropping the LDL, those were mixed diet studies, so that all the Framingham studies were done in people who were eating a diet that contained carbohydrates. So I'm not really certain that you can compare those results because there's a lot of evidence that you change the type of LDL that you have from the dense, small, dangerous type to the large, fluffy, helpful type when you increase the percentage of fat in your diet. So really, we don't have any studies yet that compare the outcomes long-term of these two different metabolic approaches.
I think there are...
Exactly. Let me just say something. This is Lisa Sanders. I think that one of the great benefits of the recent research into low-carbohydrate diets is that it points up how little we understand the relationship between what we eat and how our cholesterol responds. I mean, I think that there's not a doctor in this country who thought that if you ate a diet like that's as heavily involved in saturated fats as Atkins diet or South Beach diet, there's not a person in this country who thought that people's cholesterol would go down, and yet they did. Some of that certainly had to do with the weight loss, but I think that some of it shows that it's a very complicated relationship, and the simple formulas we've had for it, eat less fat and you'll have less fat in your vessels and you will be healthier, is not, you know, that just shows that it's not clear. The Mediterranean diet, a diet that I think would be considered a high-fat diet, you know, this is the diet that they eat in Greece and Italy that features a lot of olive oil, a lot of green vegetables, and a lot of fish, as well as meat. That actually improved people's mortality after a heart attack. So if you put people in the Lion study done in France, in Lyon, if you put people who had had a heart attack already and so were at very high risk for having another heart attack on a Mediterranean diet, which is high in monounsaturated and unsaturated fats, their risk of having a second heart attack drops dramatically. Whereas if you put them on the traditional low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet, you got the usual reoccurrence of heart disease. So I think that one of the great things that have come out of all this excitement and scientific interest in this diet is it's bringing to light how little we know at this point about the relationship between what we eat and what our blood does with it in terms of our cholesterol. I think it's completely unclear.
Well, I do agree it's unclear, but I do believe there is good solid science out there. The science of nutrition really has advanced a lot over the last 30 years, and I think there are good explanations for it. One of the examples that you brought up was the Mediterranean diet. The Mediterranean diet was originally presented by Dr. Ansel Keys, and he was presented the diet as a 40% fat diet by calories, and that diet was shown on the island of Crete and Corfu to bring about lower incidence of cardiovascular disease. However, one of the things they didn't point out was that the diet was very low in cholesterol, and the people worked 8-10 hours a day at vigorous exercise to help burn off the olive oil. And a recent study has just gone back and take a look at it, and it really wasn't a 40% fat diet. It was actually on the island of Corfu, when the calculations were done correctly, it was a 27% fat diet, which is certainly better than 40. However, if we look around the world at studies done on people who are on a 10% fat diet, such was done as by T. Colin Campbell in China. The China Project is the largest, most significant study ever done on the relationship between diet and diseases. And what he found was there is where the people ate a diet around 10% total calories in fat, about 9.6% total calories in protein, and around 80% complex carbohydrates, that the incidence of heart disease, stroke, and numerous cancers that are killing Americans at extremely high rates were virtually non-existent. So there really is good science out there. Besides those science there, we have the studies originally done by Nathan Pritikin, where he showed plaque reversal from the arteries on a diet around 10% total calories and fat.
But, you know, also, not to belabor this, but in the New England Journal very recently, there was a study that looked at people in Greece and looked at how closely they adhered to a Mediterranean diet, which has a higher fat content than Nathan Pritikin would certainly allow. And again, the closer they adhered to a typical Mediterranean diet, the better their mortality was.
That's
so true. I think that even though it is true that eating a very low-fat diet is very good for you, it's not clear that eating a diet other than that is very bad for you.
Well, is this Dr. Vernon who was speaking there?
No, that was Dr. Sanders.
Okay. Yeah, okay. I think there are some examples where diets that are high in fat are very damaging to people. There have been two in-depth studies done on remote groups of people who are on an Atkins-type diet. One of them is the diet of the Inuit Eskimos in North Greenland. And what they found was these Eskimos on this high-fat diet had a high incidence of plaques in their arteries. even more interesting that they didn't die of heart disease because the high protein diet left the body in an acid condition, and that acid condition leaches calcium out of the bones. And so the Eskimos on the original Eskimo diet were dying at 40, 45 years old from the complications of broken bones because of osteoporosis. The other study was done on the Maasai in Central Africa. The Maasai are on a diet that's high in fat, high in animal products. And when Dr. George Mann reported his study on that in 1972, it was shown that they had massive plaques in their arteries. Prior to that, they thought the Maasai were free of it because they didn't have heart attacks. But the reason they didn't have heart attacks was because they spent their childhood chasing their cattle on foot, which gave them unusually large arteries, so that even though they had large plaques, it was not blocking the arteries entirely when they got older. But in both of those cases, high-fat, high-protein diets have been shown to be extremely detrimental. And in those diets, similar to the Atkins diet, there's no reason to believe that the long-term results in the Atkins diet is going to be any different.
Okay, I want to mention really quickly, you're listening to The Aware Show on KPFK, and we're doing a panel on low-carb diets. Dr. Mary Vernon is with us. She specializes in low-carb diets. You were just hearing from Mark Lovendale, who talks more about the pro-carb diet. And then Dr. Sanders, who's a scientist, has some statistics on diets overall. I want to ask you, Dr. Sanders, doesn't it matter what kind of fats we're eating? I mean, we're not talking about Twinkies and saturated fats. What about essential fatty acids? What about fish oils? What about flaxseed oils and things like that? Could that, if that was high, if you were high in those types of fats, wouldn't those actually significantly reduce the plaqued arteries and the risk of heart disease?
Well, there's a lot of interesting research that's been done, and a lot of it is epidemiologic, you know, looking at whole populations, and there are whole populations that eat an extraordinary amount of fish and do rather well, and other, you know, communities that have extremes of diet. And those hint at what might be, but as we all know from the Hirsch trial, you know, which recently suggested that perhaps replacement of estrogen wasn't the best thing for women. You know, epidemiology will only take you so far. You really have to do the research, and I think that we're in a phase right now where we are doing research on this. So, I mean, I think it's clear that a diet high in saturated fat has been linked to heart disease, and it's clear that diets high in trans fatty acids, which are, you know, in a lot of these very simple carbohydrates and all these pastries and, you know, things that are made with refined sugar, a lot of them have very high levels of trans fatty acids, and that seems to be associated with increased risk of heart disease. Monounsaturated fats and polyunsaturated fats, the case isn't quite as clear.
Let's go back to the...
Lisa?
Yes, Dr. Vernon.
This is for Lisa Sanders.
Oops.
When you say that there's been a clear link between saturated fat and heart disease, I think that we should try to be clear and say that that's in a diet where there's not a where carbohydrates are not controlled. So
okay.
Portion might be controlled and total calories might be controlled, but carbohydrates are not. So
it's true.
I'm completely with you on the point of, this is an exciting time. There's lots of research to be done. I would be saying that in my mind, certainly, and in my private practice, low-fat diets have really failed Americans. My patients have not done well on that. I see over and over again type 2 diabetics who come in telling me that they absolutely did what they were told to do by the dietitian, and they gained weight, and their diabetes got worse. So for some people, at least the ones I see, there are people who do not benefit from that approach, and I'm not certain that we can really say what happens with fat if you control carbohydrates. I like the point about you can't just trust epidemiologic studies, because I think that's very important. And when we're talking about populations like the Maasai and the Inuit, those people have tremendous stressors in their lives, which can also contribute to their storage metabolism and to the deposition of plaque. As we know, inflammation plays a very important role in this. So So we have to, at some point in time, really do the bench science that separates these factors out, and it is an exciting time.
I think one of the things that will help to understand what the differences are here is that lots of times things are called a low-fat diet. In other words, the American Heart Association diet's called low-fat, but it's actually 25% total calories and fat. And when it was compared to the diet of 10% fat by Dean Ornish in his published study, it showed that people on the 25% fat diet continued to build plaques in their arteries, while people on the 10% fat diet, they actually reduce plaques in their arteries. And in speaking of diabetes, when the dietary levels of fat get around 10% of total calories in fat, it makes the insulin much more effective. And the insulin then is able to work on the glucose in the blood and free people of their type 2 diabetes. This was shown in Nathan Pertikan's original study. He had a large group of type 2 diabetics, and by the end of the study, over 50% of them were free of their insulin, over 80% of them were free of their oral drugs, and when they were on a diet that was around 10% total calories in fat, 10% total calories in protein, and 80% complex carbohydrates. We're all in agreement that I believe that the sugar is a huge problem in the American diet. However, when we are coming off of sugar, let's not go on to the kind of foods like steak and eggs and cheeses that have been shown clearly to be contributing factors not only in heart disease but also in numerous cancers.
Let's move this on to that conversation about protein. We've covered fats, but it has a lot to do with the protein. The low-carb diets have an emphasis in protein. Now, there's a lot of research that shows that protein being difficult to digest is, of course, hard, and you would know this from the bariatric point of view, Dr. Vernon, that the high protein is very, very taxing on the system in terms of leaching minerals from the bones and so forth in order to digest the proteins. And the amount of time and energy that it takes for the protein to assimilate into the body is also a factor in health where it's concerned with protein. So what I guess my question is here, is there another way of getting the protein in the diet? Now, the World Health Organization recommends 10 to 15% of total calories come from protein. NASA research shows that humans have their protein needs met while eating 7% of their total calories in protein. Is there enough protein that can be gained from vegetables in order to supplement in terms of vegetarian Atkins-style diet?
Well, I'm happy to have patients get their protein source from whatever sort of protein they like.
Dr. Sanders?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were directing it to me.
Who
this
speaking?
Is Dr. Vernon.
Sorry. I keep confusing you guys. I'm sure the listeners are as confused as I am. Sorry about that. You just try to address yourself. Dr. Vernon and Sanders sound a lot alike there.
Well, this is Dr. Vernon.
Thank you.
Answering your question about the
protein.
Two things. You asked about the protein and about the potential for leaching minerals. And interestingly enough, there was just a study published recently that demonstrated that actually vegetarians had a higher risk of osteoporosis than people who ate meat as their protein source. That's just one study. Dr. Sanders' point is still operational. We're in the exciting time of learning about this, and I don't know that we can say for sure that that is the definitive word. However, osteoporosis is not clinically a problem in people who use the Atkins approach. You just don't see it happen. We look for it, don't see it. So we have to someday say why, but right now it's not clinically a problem. You asked about getting protein from vegetable sources, and if people want to do that, it's fine with me if they are able to balance their carbohydrate and protein so that they are able to be metabolically healthy. And that is an individual state for each person. Some people can tolerate a much higher level of carbohydrates. I agree with Mark. Sugar's a problem, and we need complex carbohydrates. The Atkins diet is very strong on making certain that people understand that we want low glycemic carbohydrates. Those are the choices we want.
You know, this is Dr. Sanders. You know, it's interesting that these two diet perspectives that you're hearing agree on so much. In fact, you know, everybody in the nutritional world pretty much thinks that high glycemic index carbohydrates are bad, that all these sugars and trans fatty acids in a lot of the refined and highly processed foods that are part and parcel of the American diet, those are the first things that both of those diets throw out. And I think that if we could, you know, use a magic wand, I think that everybody who knows anything about nutrition would get rid of, you know, would reduce their those foods in our diet, no matter which way you ended up going on the fat and the carbohydrate. I think that another thing that these two diets have in common is that they're both very hard to adhere to. You know, I see my in my book, The Perfect Fit Diet, my approach is you have to eat, because this diet is for the rest of your life, you have to eat in a way that's pleasurable for you, because you will not eat a diet that you don't like. We live in a world that has way too many great things to offer, things that are like designed to speak to our animal cells and, you know, fulfill our every wish for fat and salt and everything else, sugar. So you can't eat a diet that you don't enjoy. And so that also has to be taken into consideration. And both of these diets share in common the fact that they really restrict the variety of foods you eat. And most people, that's a very hard thing to give up, variety.
Well, Lisa, this is Dr. Vernon, and I'll have to respectfully agree with some of what you said, but respectfully disagree with another portion, which is that what my patients report to me is that as they find their individual level of appropriate carbohydrate intake, that they find it much easier to do this. It doesn't require a scale. It doesn't require a calculator or a measuring cup, and it's a simple thing to do for the rest of your life. You can take it everywhere with you because it doesn't take any equipment. You can get full, you can feel good, your energy level can be high. Once again, the refined sugar point that you made and that Mark made, that's absolutely the cornerstone of good nutrition now. Take that, take away the refined sugar and the refined carbohydrates.
Yes, I do think we can all agree on that, but I do want to be very clear here that there is really a very significant disagreement between people like Nathan Pritikin and Dr. John McDougall and Dr. Dean Ornish, who have been treating patients for over 20 years with a diet that's around 10% total calories and fat, and a diet that has around 80 milligrams max of cholesterol per day. Comparing that to the Atkins diet, which is over 50% total calories and fat, and around 800 milligrams of cholesterol a day. Now, it is true that people can sometimes be satisfied when they're on that, but they would be much less satisfied if they knew that the diet they were on was had been shown to be a major contributing factor to a broad range of different diseases, besides heart disease. Very careful studies have been done around the world on the amount of fat in the diet and breast cancer. And where women around the world have a diet around 10% total calories and fat, breast cancer is almost unknown. When it goes up to 25% fat, as it is on Mediterranean diets, the incidence of breast cancer doubles. And when it goes up to the American level, it doubles again. And there's a clear cause and effect relationship with fat in the diet and breast cancer and prostate cancer and about 15 other common cancers that are plaguing Americans. So when Americans learn what the fat they're doing and the cholesterol they're eating does to their health, I'm sure they'll be able to find foods that satisfy them, because there's a broad range of fruits and vegetables and tubers and legumes. Actually, the majority of the foods fall in that category, and not in the area of steak and eggs and cheese.
Okay.
It is interesting that you bring up the breast cancer connection, because my understanding of the literature is that carbohydrate analysis was not done. Those were all diets that did contain many more carbohydrates than Dr. Atkins might have recommended, but that the literature is suggesting that it's actually the elevated insulin levels that are contributing to the development of the cancer. And an abstract just published in the American Heart Association Epidemiology and Prevention Meeting of this year showed that low carbohydrate diets altered a hormone called adiponectin that, in a favorable way, that would actually be shown to decrease breast cancer, endometrial cancer, and some of these other cancers. So certainly in a mixed diet, a diet with carbohydrates and fat and too many calories, there's no question that that has health implications across the board, but that can't be transferred to diets that are restricted in carbohydrates.
I think it can be transferred because you can see where people on a 10% fat diet with 80% complex carbohydrates, their insulin sensitivity goes up and the incidence of diabetes drops dramatically. You can take a look at the incidence of diabetes in populations around the world where on a 10% fat diet and type 2 diabetes is almost unknown. And as far as the low carbohydrate, high fat, high protein diet of the Eskimos, the incidence of breast cancer was quite high, similar to the American women. So I think there is enough data out there. I think the research was really done in the 70s and the 80s that came together and demonstrated that plaque reversal can take place in the arteries when people avoid excess amounts of fat and cholesterol in the diet. And I think it's very important for people to learn that some of the foods that are high in complex carbohydrates are a problem for them, because in the kind of research that we do, we find that wheat, as an example, is often upsetting to the immune system, often kills a person's white blood cells, causes a number of complications, including addictions to foods. And when people find they're compatible foods with their immune system and the 10% fat, 10% protein, 80% complex carbohydrate, the synergistic effect of those two approaches is remarkable in reversing and preventing diseases.
I'm going to take this opportunity to take a quick break. We are talking about the low-carb diet craze that's going on right now. There's many different perspectives we're bringing about on this show, and we're going to take a quick break from this conversation, and then we're going to come back and talk a little bit more about the protein conversation we were starting earlier, but it keeps leading us back to the fat. So far, everyone agrees that the high glycemic index foods are bad, but yet we're still trying to figure out here if, not necessarily that it's the carbs are good or bad, but there are different perspectives on this low-carb, high-carb diet, and we're going to keep going through this when we come back. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Aware on KPFK. Welcome back to Aware. This is Lisa Garr. We're speaking with Dr. Mary Vernon, who specializes in low-carb diets. She's a bariatric physician, and there's also Dr. Lisa Sanders, who is a scientist. She's an internist. She specializes in the treatment of overweight and obese patients. And then Mark Lovendale is here. He's a health researcher, and he's done extensive research on the on food allergies, and he is talking about the high complex carb diet. Now, Mark, you had explained to me at one point that there was a kind of a marketing campaign that's being done around this low-carb diet, where there has been an excellent marketing company procured to start to infuse the idea of low-carb diets into fast food chains, thus kind of exposing this diet concept to the public and maybe hopefully creating a trend. Is that something that you have statistics on?
Yeah, the Atkins Nutritionals has done an excellent job of promoting their line of food products, which are essentially those that are high in fat and low in carbohydrates and high in protein. And they have also enrolled different restaurants in promoting Atkins-type meals. However, this approach is has a number of problems in it. One of the problems was that the Atkins diet originally was high in saturated fat. And in January of this year, they made a correction in that and reduced the amount of saturated fat in the diet from up to 27% to under 20%. And certainly that's a step in the right direction. But the direction that it needs to go is much further. And I'm concerned that people are still purchasing foods that are high in saturated fat without the awareness of the added complications of saturated fat and heart disease.
Dr. Vernon, go ahead.
This is Dr. Sanders.
Okay.
You know, one of the things that the conversation about fats or low-carb versus high-carb diets has done has gotten us away from one of the really basic fundamentals here. When we talk about carbs, how many carbs are you eating, how much fat is in that, we're forgetting, we're losing track of calories. And calories are key to both of these diets. You know, in the Atkins diet or in these low-carb diets that were studied, most of them had, even though they were ad-lib diets, that means you could eat as much as you wanted as long as you didn't go over the certain amount of carbohydrates that you were allowed, but otherwise you could eat as much as you wanted of all the other kinds of foods, they still naturally seem to eat a low-carb or a low-calorie diet, as low as the amount of calories in people who are on a deliberately restrictive low-calorie diet. So when we talk about, you know, the complex carbohydrates and fats and how much fat and how much this, what we're forgetting is how many calories are in it. And so I think the real problem with these low-carb foods that are being integrated everywhere is that what they're going to do to low-carb diets is going to be what these low-fat foods that were really very high in calories, and even though they had less fat, did to a low-fat diet. It's going to ruin it for everybody. If you ate a low-carb diet, you would naturally be eating a relatively low-calorie diet. If you ate a diet that was very restricted in fats, you would naturally be eating a low-calorie diet. But when you bring in all these fake foods where you artificially remove the carbs or the fat and replace it with sugar, because that's what replaces most of these things, well, you're going to mess up the diet. You're going to add calories so that even though you're going to stick to the basic tenets of a low-carb or a low-fat diet, you're going to blow the calories, and that's going to make the diet not effective anymore.
Certainly calories are very important. However, when in this New England Journal of Study was done on a randomized trial that I had mentioned earlier that's promoted by the Atkins Nutritionals, they showed that at the end of 1 year, the amount of weight loss was 9.5 pounds. That's after 1 year, the average weight loss was 9.5 pounds. On obese patients on a 10% fat diet, as done by Nathan Pritikin and John McDougall and Dr. Dean Ornish, they get 20 pounds weight loss in the first month. And so the Atkins...
Well, remember, in that study, people lost dramatic amounts of weight and then slowly regained it. And that's also what you see with these very low-fat diets.
Yes,
I mean, it's very
study,
hard
was...
to live these very restrictive diets. And
well,
that's one of my key problems with both of these types of diets, is that they're very restrictive in what you can eat.
Well, the 10% fat diet actually has a broad range of different foods to eat on that, and while Nathan Pritikin is the person who is most noted for starting that type of diet and making it popular, and Dr. Robert Atkins is the person most noted for making the low-carbohydrate diet popular today, there really are significant differences between their two positions. And in 1980, there was a historic debate between the two people. Pritikin and Atkins debated at the Bonaventure Hotel in Los Angeles at a medical convention. And in that debate, all these different things that we've been talking about here were well examined, and the evidence was shown that diets that are high in fat are high risk for heart disease, and weight loss is often temporary. And it is possible to stay on a 10% fat diet. If people would like to hear that debate, I have put it up on the website at preventivecare.com, and they can go there and listen to the actual debate between Nathan Pritikin and Robert Atkins and hear for themselves the differences between these two different approaches.
Lisa, I want to jump in and talk to Dr. Sanders for just a moment and then back to Mark also. But Dr. Sanders' point about not eating fake foods but eating real foods is actually a major part of the Atkins Nutritionals basic approach, and so much so that Dr. Traeger was actually on television last week saying you need to eat food. Now, I will say that many of my patients are grateful
for somebody providing them with a food that they could carry easily with them and have occasionally as a meal substitute. So I see them learning to use these products not as their subsistence diet, but as a way to make their diet functional in our very fast-paced world where you can't always get somewhere to eat what you would like to eat. Back to the saturated fat issue, I think I need to bring you up to the current state, Mark. That actually was not Atkins' position. It was a position reported by a New York Times reporter who did not have the accurate facts. That discussion of fat came from an actual analysis of an induction diet. So the first level of Atkins' program, which is induction, contains, if people eat ad lib, as Lisa said they do, then you have about 20% saturated fat, because that's about the ratio that saturated fat appears in natural foods anyway. So Atkins' position never changed. People are allowed to eat until they're full, until they're satiated, on foods that are a broad range of protein sources, leafy green vegetables, low glycemic vegetables, and that's the basis for the Atkins approach.
I think if you actually check in his book, you will see that Atkins actually thought the 27% total calories in saturated fat was fine. And on January 20th, the representative, Heimowitz, for the Atkins Nutritional said they had changed it to being under 20% because of all the copper complications from saturated fats. But the real story here is, if you have your saturated fats not at 20%, but if you have them at 2 or 3% and your total fat around 10% and your total protein around 10% and the rest complex carbohydrates, you can be free of excess weight. The weight stays off throughout the rest of your life. When T. Colin Campbell did the study in China, they had people on high complex carbohydrates diets and they had virtually no obesity whatsoever. And their diet was 58% refined carbohydrates from white rice, and they actually ate more calories than the average American, but because of more exercise and the fact that the calories are well utilized and not deposited as fat, the Chinese were thin.
Can you really compare the people in China to the people in America? We have a completely different lifestyle and completely different environment and stress levels.
That's true. There are a number of differences. One is they exercise much more. In other words, they walk to work and they often did physical labor during the day, and exercise is a very important part of this. However, yes, we can learn a lot from them because we've seen examples where the Japanese have been healthy in Japan and then with low incidence of breast cancer on a 10% fat diet, and then after two generations of living on the West Coast, they were having breast cancer at the same rate that American women are having, which is a pandemic rate. And the mechanisms for how fat in the diet causes breast cancer by depriving the cells of oxygen and causing them to mutate is well known, well documented.
You're also talking about saturated fats and hydrogenated oils and fats that are obviously bad for the system, as opposed to some of the essential fatty acids and some of the more assimilable fats.
Yeah, the essential fatty acids are important. However, if the diet's very low in fat, around 10% total calories, all of the fatty acid needs are fully met by that. And the when the NASA actually did a study as to what level of fats humans need to meet all their needs, they actually found that 1% of total calories in fat was all the human body needed, and at a 10% fat, you're way above that.
I still believe that every body is different, and that's one of the approaches that Dr. Sanders takes in her book, is that she gives many different types of diets for different types of people because every body is different. What do you think about the blood typing? I'm going to ask Dr. Sanders. Is there any validity in the type O being more towards the meat eater type of thing? Have you ever done any research on that?
I haven't, and I'm not sure that anybody has. You know, it comes out of a non-Western tradition, which is fine. But you know, the only ways we have of studying them are, you know, I only know how to evaluate things that are done in a Western style. And so until those studies are done, I think that's it just remains something that sort of lots of people believe. I haven't ever seen anything that explained it at the level of physiology.
Yeah, I have.
And my own feeling is that if that diet works for you and you can stick to that and it your cholesterol is okay and your weight is okay. Mazel tov.
Right.
Here's what the theoretical underpinnings are.
Yeah, there aren't actually theoretical scientific underpinnings for it, and the claim in that diet is if you're an O type blood that you can have eat large amounts of meat and have cholesterol levels of 250 and not have heart disease, but when you actually look at autopsy studies in the United States, 48% of the people are type O blood, and they're dying at the same rate of heart disease as the other type. So there really isn't any science behind that.
I wanted to go back to the protein conversation. Now, protein in the body has proven to leach minerals from the bones, so therefore it does promote...
It's just that what it leaches, that what it does, it causes an acid condition in the body,
right.
And that leaches not only minerals from the bones, but it also leaches minerals from all the other tissues in the body. In other words, it leaches magnesium and other important minerals from the heart muscle. And it's one of the reasons why people on Atkins-type diets have cardiac arrhythmias. In fact, there's now cases in the evidence where people who've been on his diet, one girl as young as 16 years old, went into cardiac arrest and died because of being on the diet, which is dangerously high in protein because it leaches the minerals out of the body. And this is the same kind of problem that Dr. Atkins complained about himself having cardiac arrhythmias, and the mechanism is too much protein in the diet.
Mark, that is absolutely not true. And I'm surprised that you have sort of dropped your level of participation from the more scientific, because Dr. Atkins is known to, and what his cardiologist went on Dateline and said, he had a viral cardiomyopathy. They knew when he contracted it. He lived on his diet for 40 years and didn't have arrhythmias. Arrhythmias are not an issue with the Atkins diet, and leaching of minerals isn't an issue. I just told you that there was, again, a study recently published that supported the use of protein in terms of enhancing bone health, and it happens through a hormonal mechanism, not through an acid-base mechanism. So I think we need to really seriously look at the science. Low-fat diets have failed the American public. I'm willing to say that there are certainly individual differences, and people need to find their individual diet that works for them. And for me, the Atkins technique has proven to do that with my patient population. It's the best thing I've ever seen. And I did a study with people who did low-fat and medication versus low-carbohydrate, and I got better weight loss outcomes and better metabolic outcomes. That's the important point. Starvation certainly takes the plaque out of your arteries. It doesn't make you healthy.
Right. No one's suggesting starvation here. And in fact, the acid reaction to the bones is a well-established fact. At 16% total calorie in protein, the body goes into negative mineral balance. There are numerous studies on it. You can find them, some of them on my website at preventivecare.com. The research has been done on this. The optimum level of protein for humans, we can get a great clue from mother's milk. We do our most rapid growth during the first 4 years of our life, and mother's milk is around 7 to 8% total calories and protein, and that's what's needed for growth.
It is very difficult to tell because if the people on the Atkins diet actually had these issues of heart disease, because it is based on the individual. It really can't be told from the protein. But I understand Dr. Vernon's opinion, and that is pretty much her. I want to wrap the show up here. And Dr. Vernon, you just stated that you don't believe that heart disease is related to the high protein intake. Mark, you believe that heart disease is related to the high protein intake.
High protein plus high fat plus high cholesterol.
And Dr. Sanders, if I could get you to just give us one overall of the view of what you believe about the low-carb versus high-carb diets.
Let me just say about fat and heart disease and protein and heart disease. I'm not worried about heart disease with respect to protein. I think that protein, a very high protein diet, we have to worry about whether it does cause osteoporosis. We have to worry about whether it does cause kidney damage, something that we haven't really talked about. I think the risk of arrhythmias is much less pressing. With respect to saturated fats and other fats, I think that it's becoming clear that there is a population for whom a high-fat, high-saturated-fat diet is an invitation to heart disease. And this is probably a pretty common genetic phenotype. But it's not universal. I think that it's beginning to be shown that. I think there's some very important scientists in this area who are who have that opinion and have research that supports it. I think that what you, the way to manage your diet is to find a way of eating that you can live with. You know, people think a diet is a way to lose weight, but it's not. A diet is simply what you eat. And that diet either works for you, that is, lets you maintain the weight and health you want, or it doesn't. And I would say that most of the people in the United States, their diet ain't working. When you think about changing that diet, you can't think of it as if you're going out on a date. You know, that guy with the motorcycle and the tattoos is great to date, but you have to think about a diet as a lifelong commitment, like marriage. And you're not going to be thinking about the guy on the motorcycle necessarily when
okay.
it's time to get married.
Good
you
point.
You have to think about it as a long-term relationship, and it has to be based on what's good for you and what you like.
Well,
both things are important.
As the topic of nutrition would always have it, there's always a controversial issues when it comes to the body, because each individual body is different no matter how you look at it, and that's the beauty of us. But I think the information that we got from each and every guest and the statistics that were brought up were valid, and I do encourage people to, once again, always make your own decisions. And if you want to access anybody's website here, Dr. Mary Vernon is at... is it Atkins.com?
Yes, www.atkins.com.
Okay, and then Mark Lovendale is at preventativecare.com.
That's actually Preventive Care, P-R-E-V-E-N-T-I-V-E-C-A-R-E, one word,
thanks.
preventivecare.com.
Okay, and Dr. Sanders, where can people look up information on you and the Perfect Fit Diet?
They can go to prevention.com, www.prevention.com.
Okay, sounds like we're kind of all on the same page here. Well, once again, thank you very much for joining me this afternoon. It's been an informational show. I believe that we all have agreed on the one thing, is that high glycemic food, if index foods, are bad. That means foods that are high in sugar. We are, as Americans, addicted to those foods. So I think that that is one thing that we can all agree on. So thank you very much for your participation.
Thank you for having me.
And
thank
for
you.
All of your perspectives. All right. Bye-bye now. And that is it for me this afternoon. I want to thank our crack producer team who put the show together. And I think we've run out of time. So while I'm committed to bringing you the clearest information possible in the end, I always encourage you to listen to your own truth. Until tomorrow, I invite you to stay aware.